8 years ago today that a monster named Katrina unleashed fury on New Orleans and the people of the Gulf Coast. Well, some in the region are using the anniversary to commemorate lives lost and forever changed by the disaster. Others are launching a campaign to fight what they call a rewriting of history. They say that the George W. Bush Presidential Library and Museum in Texas glosses over the administration's role in the failed response to Katrina. Groups like Levees.org and the Bridge Project are pushing for changes to the museum's Katrina exhibit, which they say presents a watered-down version of the federal response. You may recall thousands were left stranded in New Orleans days after the storm, surrounded by rising floodwaters, and the federal government took days to send in rescue crews. We reached out to the Bush Library for comment and received a statement, which reads in part, "The area of the Bush Museum exhibit dedicated to Hurricane Katrina is located within a section pertaining to crisis management, all told from the level of presidential decision-making before, during, and after the storm. In addition, Hurricane Katrina is one of the four scenarios visitors can choose in the museum's Decision Points Theater. Visitors are given the opportunity to fully explore the many issues related to the response to Katrina, and as with the other exhibit elements, criticism of the federal and state responses is acknowledged."
Armstrong can't park on Congo Square now, because they're there now, from canal to the fairgrounds. This government doesn't repair towns or tears down the self-concepts of the descendants of ex-slaves. While ex-FEMA Chief Brown still gets paid and George Bush waves from the skies, he flies by an Air Force One, gets as close to the sun as he could manage, and Barbara Bush whispers that the tragedy is working out to our advantage. But how do you assess the damage when neglected levees let the lake walk to the river walk and talk is cheap? So I double up and repeat, ex-FEMA Chief Brown was still getting paid. While the price of oil was rising with the tides, and the children of ex-slaves still survive, and a wave crashes into the attic, and there's automatics in the hands of juvenile soldiers that told you to back that ass up, but keep bumping you against the wall before they march off to the cadence of "They the fools and the pimped out Gucci suits," that we have permission to shoot first, ask questions later, curfew at 9, bringing Cajun Moon on the crossfader. What do you say to people who have no home? Is it Astrodome or Superdome, or move in with a relative, but then that's relative, and you have to move from NO to Alaska? Or you torn, you saw how they feel about you on the nightly news. Ain't no place like home, so it's gotta be the shoes that moves us from evacuees to refugees. They might as well burn the body of King Oliver in effigy and do a second line to Little Rascals. The rebirth of George Bush's legacy is FDM. And pass the blow, cause after the show is the after party, and after the party, you know, still ain't the priority that I rock is. Bear witness, energy company profits ain't never been this strong. I swear, the heads of the top three oil companies must have brought gifts to Bush's manger when he was born.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Injection, fellas.
This is the conspiratorial view of history, as opposed to the accidental view. And it is the conspiratorial view that we shall present in this program.
FBI headquarters. FBI headquarters. I'll connect you. FBI headquarters.
This is Second Sunday, NBC Radio's award-winning news documentary series. This month's topic, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. Second Sunday recently took a tour of the FBI building in Washington.
My name is Keith Russell, and I'd like to welcome you to your tour of the FBI this morning. At any time during the tour, if you have any questions, please feel free to ask, and I'll do my very best to answer them for you. If you will, please, let's turn directly around behind us. Right here, we see two dignitaries that have offices in the building. Now, this is the Attorney General John N. Mitchell. He's a former law partner of President Nixon. He took office on January 19, 1969. Now, this is our director of the FBI, Mr. J. Edgar Hoover. He became director May 10, 1924. He's now 76 years of age. Are there any questions?
I'm Edwin Newman, NBC News, and I have some questions. They flow out of the current controversy about the FBI and about the long tenure in office of the Bureau's director, J. Edgar Hoover. I've discussed these questions with two of the foremost authorities on law enforcement in the country. They are Milton Rector, Executive Director of the National Council on Crime and Delinquency, and Ralph Salerno, expert on organized crime and a one-time member of a presidential commission on crime. Mr. Salerno, do you think that J. Edgar Hoover has stayed on too long?
Well, I think, you know, as a package deal, I'm glad that he was born and lived and took over the FBI in 1924 when it was really a corrupt institution and nothing much of value. And I'm glad that he built it into the most efficient investigation force in the United States. I think I would feel that perhaps he has stayed too long. In 1964, he reached a mandatory retirement age. I think part of the responsibility of any top administrator, after having been in a position for many years, is to develop leadership that can follow and take over. I would not like to believe there is an indispensable man anywhere in government.
A one-man organization can never be a strong organization, really. So it's not in disrespect of anyone when they reach the time when younger men and more vital men are needed that you say that they've reached the retirement period.
In recent months, a number of senators and representatives have been attacking J. Edgar Hoover, seeking his ouster. One of these is Senator George McGovern, who explains why he feels Hoover recently has been in contempt of Congress.
Well, the trouble with Mr. Hoover's recent position is that he has told the Congress of the United States that he can't comment on the dismissal of one of his agents, Agent John Shaw, because the case is in court. And then he writes a letter to one of the metropolitan newspapers of this country and perhaps to a number of newspapers explaining his whole case to the public. Now, he can't have it both ways. He can't tell the Congress that it's impossible for him to comment on this case because it's in the courts and then turn around and make his explanation to the public through letters to the editor.
The former agent mentioned by Senator McGovern is John Shaw. He resigned from the Bureau involuntarily with prejudice after being critical of some FBI procedures. The criticisms were contained in a letter to a professor while Shaw was doing graduate work in the field of criminal justice. Mr. Shaw, you had 7 years with the FBI. How well do you believe it is serving the American people?
Well, Mr. Newman, unfortunately, I feel, from my observations, that the overall impact of the Bureau administration is counterproductive to the work or the productivity of the working agents.
Why is that? I mean, what's wrong with the administration?
I think we get back to that terrible phrase that the director doesn't like to hear, personality cult. And I think that anyone keeping his eyes open has a feeling after a few years in the system that everything and every aspect of every investigation revolves ultimately around the personality of Mr. Hoover. To the working agent, it doesn't take him too long to realize what types of cases please the Bureau and what types of cases, apart from their investigative merits, will more likely be followed with interest by the Bureau hierarchy.
Do you yourself, Mr. Shaw, have any opinion as to whether J. Edgar Hoover has served the nation well?
I think 47 years ago, Mr. Hoover made a significant contribution to law enforcement in this country. I think that 47 years ago, however, the conditions that law enforcement faced were significantly different than they are today. I think, therefore, that my conclusion would be that times have passed Mr. Hoover by. I would argue that Alvin Karpus and George Machine Gun Kelly and Babyface Nelson and the other epical heroes of the Bureau that we hear about so often, that we read about, their pictures have been immortalized through Mr. Hoover's tenacious clinging to these stories. I would argue that these men today, and going back to examining the crimes they committed and what they were about at the time they were apprehended and the means by which they were apprehended, could fall easily within the purview of any small-town police department today. I think that we are fooling ourselves if we consider these episodes of the past the significant problems of law enforcement today.
We have liftoff of the United Launch Alliance Delta IV heavy rocket carrying the NRO L-65 mission to the National Reconnaissance Office.
The familiar countdown that means only one thing. Another U.S. spy satellite is launched into orbit so big, it had to be taken there aboard America's largest and most powerful rocket. The Delta IV Heavy rocket roared into space from California on Wednesday, carrying a top-secret defense satellite for the National Reconnaissance Office. But if you want to know why it's been sent up there to look down on us here, you'll either have to wait a long, long time, earn top-level clearance at a US intelligence agency, or find yourself a whistleblower, because all details about its mission are highly classified.
That was Bob Dylan's 60s hit, Blowin' in the Wind, the song that became an anthem for change when Peter, Paul and Mary sang it at the March on Washington 50 years ago tomorrow. Today, Juan Williams has a powerful column in the Wall Street Journal, half a century later, where he challenges people to compare the promise of that inspiring music with what Juan calls the heartbreaking contrast of today's hit rap songs, like Jay-Z's hit, Holy Grail. I mean, it has lyrics we cannot play on television, at least not this time of day. What are your thoughts?
Well, it also has lyrics that when the president likes to quote Jay-Z, he will give the edited lyrics. It's just despicable. It's outrageous. It is filled with misogyny and hateful lyrics towards women. And I think a lot of the conversation around this, Shannon, is always focused at the artists who are putting out just these really destructive lyrics and representations of women and of certain parts of the black community.
There are examples all through the rap music world. They've persisted for years with scarcely any complaint from today's civil rights leaders. One goes on to say their failure to denounce these lyrics for the damage they do to poor and minority families, words celebrating tattooed thugs and sexually indiscriminate women as icons of, quote, keeping it real, is a sad reminder of how long it has been since the world heard the sweet music of the March on Washington.
I sat down with Russell Simmons over a week ago after he put out a despicable rape tape featuring Harriet Tubman, one of our greatest heroines that this country has ever produced, and talked to him about misogyny and rap, and I got the same answer from him that I've gotten, I think, from that many people get from a lot of the icons in this industry, and it's that the reason is it's a reflection of the culture.
Now this is about to kick off, this party looks whack. Let's take it back to straight hip-hop and start it from scratch. I'm about to bloody this jack up, everybody get back. That's why my pen needs a pad, cause my rhyme's on a rat tag. Just like I did with a Dixon, I'm about to freak it. Like a magician, critics I turn to freak it. Got them still on the fence, whether to peek it. But quick to get impaled when I tell them peek it. So sick from looking pale, well that's my peek it. About to go ahead, yeah bitch, shout out to peek it. Let's bring it back to that vintage Slim bit. The order and MC Ren, and I don't mean Stimpy's friend, bitch. Been public enemy since you thought P.E. was Jim, bitch.
Kick shoes off, let your head out.
And we're shirt all night long.
Pull your beard out, just weird out.
And we're shirt all night long. We're gonna rock this house until we knock it down. So turn the volume loud. Let's get spinning to the AM. So baby, make just like cake. Better let yourself go, let yourself go. Say it before we kick the bucket. Life's too short to not go.
That I'm dressed, ain't it? Khakis pressed, Nike shoes, crispy and fresh lace. So I guess it ain't that aftershave of cologne that made him just faint. Plus I showed up with a coat freshen in wet paint. So if love is a chess game, checkmate. But girl, your body's banging, jump me in, gang, bang, bang. Yes, sir, we bob. I was thinking the same thing. So come get on this kid's rock, bob with the bob, dang, dang. Pow, 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 pow.
Chicka pow, chicka wow, wow. Got your girl blowing up a pow, 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 pow. Better slow it down, throwing the town to the town, town. Throw me down, I don't know how, how, how.
At least I know that I don't know. Question is, are you both so smart enough to feel stupid? Hope so, now hope.
Kick shoes off, let your head out.
And we're shirt all night long.
Pull your beard out, just weird out.
And we're shirt all night long. We're gonna rock this house until we knock it down. So turn the volume loud. Let's get spinning to the AM. So break the pace up like crazy. Let yourself go, let yourself go. Say it before we kick the bucket. Life's too short to not go.
I made it, no.
rub is powerful as cough syrup and styrofoam. All I knew was I fell asleep, then woke up in that Monte Carlo with the ugly Kardashian, Lamar. Oh, sorry, yo, we done both set the bar low. Bars hard, drugs hard, though that's the past. But I done get enough codeine and not future in it tomorrow. And girl, I ain't got no money to borrow, but I am trying to find a way to get you alone. Marshall Mathers, get out with the body mount. Get the bar soap lathered, Kangos and car heartless cargoes. Girl, you're fixing to get your heart broke.
Don't be absurd, man, you bird brain baby. I ain't called anybody baby since Birdman.
Unless you're a swallow.
Word, Rick, word, man, you heard. But don't be discouraged, girl, this is urgent. Unless you got toe jack.
Take shoes off, let your head out.
All night long.
Pull your feet out, just feed out.
Until we knock it down, so turn the volume loud.
Cause it's been to the end.
So maybe make just like cake. Better let yourself go, let yourself go. I say if you fit before we kick the bucket. Life's too short to not go for broke. This house until we knock it down, so turn the volume loud. Cause it's been to the end. So crank the bass up like crazy and let yourself go, let yourself go. Say it before we kick the bucket. Life's too short to not go for broke.
Obama weighs his Syria option. Military experts advise the president look at America's long, glorious history of successful bombing campaigns. And the conflict intensifies as bears enter the war. We require you to wear a jacket and tie to view this video, but your full-length evening gown is certainly acceptable too. This is The Onion Week in Review. Following yet another long, enjoyable week at their places of employment, Americans across the country reported being annoyed today about the prospect of spending a long holiday weekend away from work. According to a Zogby poll released this morning, 30% of Americans said they were already feeling the burden of the impending 3 days without work responsibilities, with well over 50% saying they preferred spending the last few days of summer surrounded by their bosses and coworkers, adding that they, quote, can't wait for Tuesday. A report on obesity rates released this week by the CDC confirmed that millions of courageous Americans continue to overcome the media's persistent pressure to be thin. Researchers told reporters that while the vast majority of film and television continues to portray thin, in-shape people, over 30% of Americans remain resolved in their effort to stand up to idealized images of men and women.
Every day, people are inundated with unvarying images of slim men and women, but millions of heroic Americans continue doing their best every day to maintain BMIs 35 or higher. These people aren't afraid to fly in the face popular culture deems acceptable and bravely eat and drink whatever they want, whenever they want.
According to employees of local technology firm Halverson Enterprises, CEO Peter Weathers has a unique talent for recognizing great ideas and absolutely ruining them. Longtime Halverson employees say they're continually impressed by Weathers' ability to water down promising ideas with meaningless jargon, consistently choose the wrong person to head up every project, and inject virtually every halfway decent thought with his own short-sighted and terrible insight.
For as long as I've worked here, Peter has been able to sit down in a meeting, listen to a million different ideas, pick out the one that makes the most sense creatively and financially, and then totally destroy it until there's basically nothing worthwhile about it left. He's remarkable.
And in this week's op-ed pages, CNN.com's managing editor explains why Miley Cyrus's VMA performance was their top story Monday. In other news, the nation's single men announce a plan to change their bedsheets by 2019. A woman who left the room crying earlier expects to jump back into the party just like that. And a courtroom artist is clearly infatuated with the bailiff. This 2.5 minute long session of immersion therapy is finally complete.
If someone told you they were going to rob 7 banks, and he listed which ones, he was like, this one, etc. Then over the coming years, he did indeed rob most of those banks. And then one day, you're walking with him past one of the few banks he hasn't robbed, and he goes, you and I have to rob this bank. Not to steal the money, but because the money is actually a bomb that's made to look like money, and so we have to grab it and bring it back to my place. Not to steal the money, just to help the people that are going to die from the bomb. That's why we have to do it. Would you believe him? Well, that's the problem with the U.S. government telling us it's now time to bomb the shit out of Syria. And here's the thing. It's not that I know what happened with chemical weapons in Syria. And it's not that I think President Assad is a lovely chap who enjoys cucumber sandwiches and patting little bunny rabbits on the back of their heads. It's simply that General Wesley Clark told us that the White House and the Pentagon have had ongoing plans to invade or otherwise dismantle seven countries. Here's a clip from the video.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, No. He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, No. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." So I came back to see him a few weeks later. And by that time, we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today. And he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran."
Go through the countries again.
Well, starting with Iraq, then Syria and Lebanon, then Libya, then Somalia and Sudan, and then back to Iran.
That's kind of damning, right? And something tells me Mr. Wesley Clark wouldn't have been so forthcoming if he had won his bid for the presidency a few years back. The other reason I'm opposed to jumping on board the old idea of bombing to save the day is because I can't picture a time we've ever done that in the past 60 years. Do we ever just bomb to save the day in a place that doesn't have some major oil interest? It's like a lifeguard who says he's there to save people's lives, but then he just ends up doing mouth-to-mouth on all the hot chicks, whether they need it or not. Meanwhile, there are hairy, obese men drowning left and right, whole piles of ugly dudes lost to the deadly activity of amateur swimming. And at some point, you gotta be like, "I don't think that lifeguard is really here to save the day." And I don't think bombing Syria has anything to do with saving people. Neither does former NATO Supreme Allied Commander, General Wesley Clark.
It was a pretty stunning thing. You mean the purpose of the military is to start wars and change governments? It's not to sort of deter conflict? We're going to invade countries? And I my mind was spinning.
Years ago, a man named L. Ron Hubbard said the real way to make $1 million is to start a religion. He then went on to start a religion. He founded Scientology, which believes Tom Cruise is the Virgin Mary and Will Smith is the burning bush. But L. Ron Hubbard didn't claim he started the religion for money. He claimed he did it because it's the true religion. Do you believe him? I should f***ing hope not. So why do we believe the White House and Congress when they say we now need to go to war with Syria to save the day? Believing that makes Scientology seem downright sensible. It's our ability to not go to war that defines us as men and women of moral principle. Going to war is easy. It's what we do. It's what we train for. It's what we spend most of our money on here in America. It's our default position, like weighted dice landing on seven, like Simon Cowell or Jamie Dimon sucking the devil's dick. And what do you know? We landed on war again. What are the odds? You see, if you're a rageaholic and you spend all day, every day figuring out how to be a better fighter, then not fighting is a huge achievement.
I stopped watching the news years ago. It just was, I couldn't watch it anymore. The same reason why I stopped going to church. I was just like, this isn't what's going on. What they're telling me is a guess. I just don't buy into it, you know? Other than, that's why I like sports. I like watching ESPN. Because what they say is true for the most part. The Phillies did win 2-1. There was 30,000 witnesses. They saw it happen. But that other shit. when you start telling me what's going on in Frankfurt or in Vienna or goddamn Cairo, I don't know. Is it? Is that what happened? Is that footage actually from that? From that place? Did that happen this week? Am I still going to keep asking questions? Will this ever end? I don't know.
On the brink of war in Syria.
What's the president going to do? What will he decide? There's any one of 6, 10, 12 things that we can just think of as we sit here right now.
What are the options?
What exactly are the options, military-wise? Are you for action at this point?
At this point, absolutely not.
Even though you don't want action, what would you recommend?
We should kill Assad.
You might as well kill him.
You got 24 hours. Get out of your palace.
I think the president will look even more foolish than he is already if he doesn't use military force.
So let's look closer at those options.
Rapidly building momentum for a U.S. military response.
Almost certain that there will be one.
It's 100% certain.
America may be on the verge of another war in the Middle East.
I think that's almost unavoidable.
It's not a question of if, but when.
Missile strikes are number one that's being considered.
The type of strike then becomes the question.
There seems to be support for a limited military strike.
2 to 3 days of bombing.
Maybe a 2-day strike and you're in and you're out.
A fairly strong, limited in time strike.
Probably a surgical strike.
A very specific targeted attack meant to send a message.
But there's a price to be paid for using chemical weapons.
Whack them to punish them.
Destroy that palace, destroy the treasury, take out the Department of Commerce. American armed forces can easily hit targets inside Syria.
We would use cruise missiles and we could certainly use our B-2 bombers.
Tomahawk missiles, surface-to-air missiles.
F-22s.
We need an aircraft carrier battle group stationed in the eastern Mediterranean. If the objective is to topple the Assad regime, let's put the forces in place throughout the region to be able to attack it, not just lob a few tomahawks from out in the eastern Mediterranean.
All right, so you get, Commander, you get the word, whether you like it or not, you have to take action.
Let's hear it. Why is the Arab world so easily offended?
Gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerers of death's construction. In the fields, the bodies burning as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning our brainwashed minds.
It's important to ask the tough questions and get the tough answers before taking action, not just afterwards. And I believe, as President Obama does, that it is also important to discuss this directly with the American people. That's our responsibility, to talk with the citizens who have entrusted all of us in the administration and the Congress with responsibility for their security. That's why this morning's release of our government's unclassified estimate of what took place in Syria is so important. Its findings are as clear as they are compelling. I'm not asking you to take my word for it. Read for yourself, everyone, those listening, all of you, read for yourselves the evidence from thousands of sources. Evidence that is already publicly available. And read for yourselves the verdict reached by our intelligence community about the chemical weapons attack the Assad regime inflicted on the opposition and on opposition-controlled or contested neighborhoods in the Damascus suburbs on the early morning of August 21st.
Politicians hide themselves away. They only started time will tell on the power minds making war just for fun, treating people just like pawns in chess. Wait till that judgment day comes.
Russian President Vladimir Putin increases efforts to head off a possible U.S.-led military strike on Syria.
Здравый смысл говорит сам за себя. Сирийские правительственные войска наступают. В некоторых регионах они окружили повстанцев.
Common sense speaks for itself. The Syrian government forces are advancing. In some regions, they have surrounded the rebels. In these circumstances, giving the winning card to those who constantly call for a military intervention is utter nonsense. It does not fit any logic, especially on the day of the arrival of the UN inspectors. So I am convinced that this is just a provocation by those who want to pull other countries into the Syrian conflict, who want to gain support from powerful international players, above all, the United States.
The U.S. planning a limited military response over what are called a brutal and flagrant attack 10 days ago. Putin still unconvinced and telling the U.S. to produce the evidence.
As for the position of our American colleagues and friends who state that the government forces have used weapons of mass destruction, in this case used chemical weapons, and say that they have evidence, let them present it to the UN inspectors and the UN Security Council.
Syria will no doubt top the agenda when the G20 leaders meet next week in St. Petersburg.
President, as you know, you follow the news because I talked to some of the people that used to work with you or work in the halls of Fox, and you see what's happening with Syria right now.
Yeah.
Now, I know you don't like to comment about what's in the news, but you can comment about the Syria you dealt with for 8 years.
I can comment about this. The president's got a tough choice to make, and if he decides to use our military, he'll have the greatest military ever backing him up.
Right. What has Syria been like for the U.S. in the 8 years that you served? Would you say that, I mean, the feeling that they had in supporting the insurgency, there was no doubt about that, am I correct?
I was not a fan of Mr. Assad. He's an ally of Iran, and he's made mischief.
Made mischief, and for a long time he felt impervious to America.
Yeah. And the president's going to have to make a tough decision.
And what about the rest of the world turning and saying, well, we're not really too sure. We're going to wait for the UN. You've been through that before.
The president has to make a tough call, Brian. I know you're trying to subtly rope me into the issues of the day. I refuse to be roped in.
I understand, but I'm not even subtly roping. I just wanted your unique perspective at the leadership level, which very few people get behind those closed doors.
Putting a military into harm's way is the toughest decision a president will make.
Money trumps peace. 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 Money trumps peace.
Thank you.
President Barack Obama speaks out on Syria, telling the world he's going to formally ask Congress to approve military action.
After careful deliberation, I have decided that the United States should take military action against Syrian regime targets. This would not be an open-ended intervention. We would not put boots on the ground. Instead, our action would be designed to be limited in duration and scope. But I'm confident we can hold the Assad regime accountable for their use of chemical weapons, deter this kind of behavior, and degrade their capacity to carry it out. I've long believed that our power is rooted not just in our military might, but in our example as a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And that's why I've made a second decision. I will seek authorization for the use of force from the American people's representatives in Congress. Our military has positioned assets in the region. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs has informed me that we are prepared to strike whenever we choose. Moreover, the chairman has indicated to me that our capacity to execute this mission is not time sensitive. It will be effective tomorrow, or next week, or 1 month from now. And I'm prepared to give that order.
Now in darkness, world stops turning. Ashes where the body's burning. No more war pigs have the power. Hand of God has struck the hour. Day of judgment, world is calling. On the knees the war pigs crawling. Begging mercy for their sins. Laughing spreads his wings.
As you've seen, today we've released our unclassified assessment detailing with high confidence that the Syrian regime carried out a chemical weapons attack that killed well over 1,000 people, including hundreds of children. This follows the horrific images that shocked us all. This kind of attack is a challenge to the world. We cannot accept a world where women and children and innocent civilians are gassed on a terrible scale. This kind of attack threatens our national security interests by violating well-established international norms against the use of chemical weapons, by further threatening friends and allies of ours in the region, like Israel and Turkey and Jordan, and it increases the risk that chemical weapons will be used in the future and fall into the hands of terrorists who might use them against us.
Mesmerized, as if by the nastiest pornographic abyss, stare into TV news each night, waiting to see a new war in full-throated hell. Even more than with the usual not-so-subliminal sexual and obedience programming, America observes, with barely repressed excitement, the ruler's satanic desires unfold on TV. A wet, wonderful Syrian wargasm is only an image away. Economies fail to remain erect, so the rulers of the patriarchy go on TV and ritually chew and swallow an economic performance enhancement pill of dung called war. These are the war masters of the Western universe on the evening news, with their predatory, great, white, capacious, enormous mouths gaped wider still by Saudi, Qatari, and Israeli houri. As I contemplate this war I do not support, I am struck by a simple observation from nearly a century ago. The war of 1914 to 1918 was imperialist, that is, an annexationist predatory war of plunder on the part of both sides, it was a war for the division of the world, for the partition and repartition of colonies and spheres of influence of financial capital. Lenin imperialism, the highest stage of capitalism. Wargasm is always emboldened by public figures crying havoc and danger, preaching a crusade against the infidel. Masters of war use arousal of sexual energy, human life energy, to bind the partner to perverse wargasm. 50 years after the civil rights movement co-optation of leaders or creation of astroturf movements by interested outsiders is a constant. Nor are our social movements able to bounce back from murder of leaders and terror against their organizations by agents of the state. 50 years after Martin Luther King, we have our black non-president of the United States non-constitutionally sworn into public office, both in public and in private, by a non-justice of a non-rival party. Our elections are non-contestants between non-disguised non-political parties. One represents oligarchs and imperialists, the other vice versa. Wargasm is the Dionysian dream date with Thanatos and Eros, lurking deep in the collective American mind, the nuclear wargasm in the Holy Land, reeking of Armageddon and prophecy, is a potent erotic symbol represented by divine mushroom clouds and sleek yellow submarines designed by Louis Vuitton.
And we have some breaking news tonight. British Parliament has voted against taking military action against Syria. Prime Minister David Cameron says he will not override the decision. And in our text poll, our viewers tend to agree, with 87% of you saying no, we should not take any military action. So at this hour, the breaking news, the Brits are saying no to an airstrike in Syria.
Fall is here, hear the yell, back to school, ring the bell, brand new shoes, walking blues, climb the fence, books and pens, I can tell that we are gonna be friends. I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
They could be deported, all because a mom and a dad want to homeschool their children. Fox News Radio's Todd Starnes has been following the story for us, and he joins us now with the new developments. Todd, what's going on here?
Well, good morning, Heather. The Romicki family fled Germany in 2008. Mom, dad, their six children, all seeking political asylum. Now, the Romickis are evangelical Christians, and the German government threatened to take away their children and throw them in jail just because they refused to stop homeschooling. The German state constitution requires children to attend public school, and parents who don't comply face severe punishment. So in 2008, with the help of the American-based Homeschool Legal Defense Association, the Romickis applied for political asylum. An immigration judge granted the family refuge, and they settled into a new life, purchasing a small Tennessee farm in the shadows of the Great Smoky Mountains. But the Obama administration stepped in and objected to political asylum. The Justice Department says no one has a right to homeschool anywhere, and they do not believe the German government has violated the family's human rights. And Homeland Security demanded the Christian family be deported. Now, the Homeschool Legal Defense Association calls the administration's position an utter repudiation of parental and religious liberty. So let's put this in perspective. President Obama is granting amnesty to millions of people who came here illegally. And just last week, the administration released thousands of illegals who had committed crimes. But they want to deport a Christian family just because they want to homeschool. Now, the Romicki family's hopes and dreams now rest with the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. And there's no word on when they might hand down a ruling.
Walk with me, Susie Lee. The park and by the tree, we will rest upon the ground and look at all the bugs we found. Safely walk to school without a sound. Safely walk to school without a sound.
three schools that we're at right here. And everything's metal. There are these little rooms, and all the windows have metal grates on them. And so do the doors. They have metal grates on the windows and doors. And everything's metal. And these little creepy metal buildings. And I have to say, when I'm walking through here, I feel like I'm walking through a prison complex or something. All the doors have numbers on them. It's like some kind of metal prison complex. This is a preschool, guys, in America. The metal preschool prison complex.
Here we are, no one else. We walk to school all by ourselves. There's dirt on our uniforms from chasing all the ants and worms. We clean up and now it's time to learn. We clean up and now it's time to learn.
But even under the new Common Core, even if they said 3 times 4 was 11, if they were able to explain their reasoning and explain how they came up with their answer really in words and in oral explanations, and they showed it in the picture, but they just got the final number wrong. We're really more focusing on the how and the way.
Going to be correcting them.
Oh, absolutely, right? Absolutely. We want our students to compute correctly, but the emphasis is really moving more towards the explanation and the how and the why, and can I really talk through the procedures that I went through to get this answer, and not just knowing that it's 12, but why is it 12? How do I know that?
Numbers, letters, learn to spell, nouns and books and show and tell. Playtime, we will throw the ball back to class, through the hall. Teacher marks our height against the wall. Teacher marks our height against the wall. We don't notice any time pass. We don't notice anything. We sit side by side in every class. Teacher thinks that I sound funny, but she likes the way you sing. Tonight I'll dream while I'm in bed, when silly thoughts go through my head about the bugs and alphabet. When I wake tomorrow, I'll bet that you and I will walk together again. I can tell that we are gonna be friends. Yes, I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
And now we come to the great man himself. A man history records as being instrumental in the creation of America's public education system. Horace Mann was an American educator who served as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, part of the American Congress. Horace Mann was the key reformer of the education system at the time. In 1837, he became the head of the newly created Board of Education in Massachusetts, where he began the work that would eventually earn him the title as the Father of American Public Education. After reading through the educational models of different countries, Mann finally hears about a particularly successful style that had been developed in Prussia, which is now modern-day Germany. The Prussian system had shown to be such a success for the government's purposes that, accompanied by a few other educators, Horace Mann travels to Germany to investigate. Upon their return to the United States, they lobbied heavily to have the Prussian model adopted.
All in favor, say aye!
Interest in Prussia had also been growing in the northern half of the continent. Around this time, the Canadian Superintendent of Schools, Egerton Ryerson, traveled to Prussia in search of a new model of education. His journeys also included visiting Horace Mann in Massachusetts to further examine the system he would eventually adopt. George Brown, the editor of Toronto's Globe newspaper, was even quoted saying that Ryerson had successfully imported Prussian education into Ontario. During the next 30 years or so, a whole line of American dignitaries came to Germany to earn degrees. Interestingly enough, those who earned degrees in Germany came back to the United States to staff all the major universities. By 1900, all the PhDs in the United States were trained in Prussia. As the first secretary of the State Board of Education, Horace Mann promoted his new concept that the state is the father of children. He stressed that it was the responsibility of the state to ensure that education was provided for the child. A very noble idea, of course, but what exactly did he mean by that? And how did he define education? It seems like a very broad subject. It is a very broad subject. Education encompasses all of human history and all the knowledge we have gathered during that time. Not to mention, and perhaps most importantly, what we as human beings learn over our lifetime on a personal level. Horstmann's 10th annual report in 1846 led to the first state law that made it mandatory for children to go to school. It was during that year that he supported the governor of Massachusetts in adopting the Prussian model of education for the entire state. How did he do that? The governor of the time, Edward Everett, as it turns out, was the very first to receive a PhD from, can you guess where? That's right, Prussia. From then on, it spread very quickly. Just after Everett installed the Prussian model in the state of Massachusetts, the governor of New York set up the very same method in 12 New York schools. Horace Mann's sister, Elizabeth Peabody, of the Peabody Foundation, saw to it that right after the Civil War, the Prussian system that was then being taught in the northern states was integrated into the conquered South. By 1900, most of the compulsory schooling laws that implemented the new system had been passed. From then on, every American child grew up under the Prussian system. So what exactly was the Prussian education system that everyone thought was so amazing that it just had to be adopted throughout the free world? To give you just a bit of background, in the 18th century, the Kingdom of Prussia, which is now modern-day Germany, was among the first countries of the world to introduce free and compulsory education. After the Prussians were defeated by Napoleon in 1806, it was decided that the reason why the battle was lost was that the Prussian soldiers were thinking for themselves in the battlefield instead of following orders. To make sure that this couldn't happen again, a new 8-year system of schooling was created. This new system provided not only the skills needed for the early industrialized world, such as reading, writing, and arithmetic, but also a strict education that taught duty, discipline, respect for authority, and the ability to follow orders. Elite children destined for higher offices went on to attend private schools, while the rest of the population had no access to the secondary education. They were destined for the working class. Through this new system, the Prussian court tried to create social obedience in the citizens through indoctrination. Every individual had to become convinced at the core of their being that the king was just, his decisions were always right, and the need for obedience paramount. In truth, the entire purpose of the system was to instill loyalty to the crown and to train young men for the military and bureaucracy. To do this, it was necessary to squeeze out all independent thinking from the masses. Influencing this new system from the beginning was Prussian philosopher Johann Gottlieb Fichte. Combining John Locke's view that the children are a blank slate and Rousseau's ideas on how to write on that slate, Prussia established an educational system that was considered scientific in nature. An important part of the Prussian system was that it defined for the child what was to be learned, what was to be thought about, and how long to think about it. In order to have an efficient policy-making class and a subclass beneath it, it was believed that one had to remove the power of most people to make sense out of the available information. In other words, critical thinking had to be done away with. Now, if you're wondering why the average person doesn't know that the North American education system is based directly on the Prussian model, it might just be because its original purpose was not designed for the good of the individual, but for the good of the government. The philosophy of Johann Fichte directly influenced the creation of the Prussian model of schooling. As he is quoted saying, "The schools must fashion the person, and fashion him in such a way that he simply cannot will otherwise than what you wish him to will." With quotes like these, you can see why his involvement is not well known. Education should aim at destroying free will, so that after pupils are thus schooled, they will be incapable throughout the rest of their lives of thinking or acting otherwise than as their schoolmasters would have wished. When this technique has been perfected, every government that has been in charge of education for more than one generation will be able to control its subjects securely without the need of armies or policemen. In 1807, in a Berlin occupied by Napoleon, Johann Fichte gave a series of famous addresses to the German nation. Fichte spoke of the superiority of German people above all others. The content of these speeches was a catalyst for the Prussian education system and German nationalism. In other earlier works, he calls Jews a state within a state, that would, quote, undermine the German nation. He openly expressed a desire to expel Jews from Germany. Fitch had a deep influence on the rise of the Third Reich, and continues to be deemed, quote, the spiritual father of modern neo-Nazism. Which begs the question, why would the father of American education make it a law that every child spend their youth in a system created by the father of neo-Nazism? Historians reflect that one of the greatest social factors that allowed a man like Hitler to rise to power was that the German people had been bred from birth to respect authority above all else and accept it without question. Which begs another question. If the entire population of North America is raised in a system adopted from pre-Nazi Germany, what are we setting ourselves up for?
Do you like being a participant in the watering can of the flowers of freedom throughout the world?
Now, go find the others.com.
Retreat! Retreat!